I won't silence my cell phone because, ironically, my father-in-law was admitted overnight. He's in critical condition in the hospital, so I may have to take a phone call. Emmanuel Moreno, a distant relative of mine, was killed 2 years ago. He was a member of the elite commando unit, Sayeret Matkal, and he was killed in northern Lebanon. I was honored to go to a yard site. Every year they get together, the commandos and friends, to memorialize people who have died. And one of the things that was pointed out about Emmanuel was that even though he did tasks well beyond the borders of Israel that cannot be discussed in public, he engaged in very highly dangerous tasks, and he was called the Bar Kokhba of his generation, and was one of the most honored soldiers. He kept halacha as best he could. As a matter of fact, when they would come to get him for an urgent mission on Shabbat, he would leave the Beit Knesset, he would leave the shul wearing his Shabbat clothing. He'd say, if I have to change, I at least want to see my kids. I want to walk out as long as I can in my Shabbos clothing. And to me, he symbolizes a person who, despite the kinds of exploits he was in, was literally fighting for the survival of the nation and for millions of people. He never wanted to compromise on halacha. He understood that there had to be a way to do his kind of work on the other end of the healing spectrum. He was more on the dispatch end, dispatching enemies. He felt, however, it was very important to keep halacha. So I want to mention that this talk is also in Pali, in his memory. Chaim Shmuel ben Pinya was an interesting man who I never had the honor of having met. He was born and raised, as I understand it, in Canada, where he traveled with his father, who was, I believe, a Moel and a Chazan. He was, today we'd call it from birth. They traveled to many communities and educated many people and tried to keep the faith, if you will. At age 16, he decided to go fight the Nazis. We fought acne when we were 16, and maybe we fought boredom, but he decided to go fight the Nazis, and he went over to Europe. He enlisted in the Canadian Army, and he kept kashrus. He did not compromise with kashrus on the battlefield, which, for anybody who can imagine, must have been a very heroic thing to do. In his 40s, he became a single parent when his wife tragically died, and he raised his children. As he entered his late 70s, he was best cared for, they felt, in a nursing facility, an old age home, if you will. And unfortunately, about 7 years prior to the perfect storm that happened in the fall of 2007, about 7 years prior to that, he fell. I don't know if he cascaded down a flight of stairs or hit his head on concrete. And he was brought in critical condition to a hospital, and the decision was made at that time to cut out a portion of his brain. His family, Orthodox Jews, wanted everything to be done, and a portion of his brain was cut out. We'll see maybe later on in the story why that becomes relevant. The portion of the brain was cut out was on the left side, and if you cut out that part of the brain in me, I'm mimicking now, not be able to speak, I'd become non-communicative. Most people know that that's called aphasia. So as part of the procedure he had 7 years before he ended up in the most recent hospitalization, he was brain damaged by the injury and possibly by the surgery that was done by the neurosurgeons at the time. He then went back, he was on a tracheostomy for a while, and he was taken off the tracheostomy. He went back to living in the nursing home where his children visited him weekly, if not daily, to see how he was doing. And he lived a fairly stable life. Around October of 2007, he started to catch pneumonia, much as my father-in-law currently is fighting in his own battle in South Florida as we speak. And he was hospitalized in Winnipeg, Canada, at the, some would say, the poorly named Grace Hospital. Others might have another term. But the name of the hospital was Grace Hospital. It was run at that time by the Salvation Army, and they were in the process of selling it to the Winnipeg Regional Healthcare Authority, which is basically a governmental organization. Most healthcare in Canada, as I understand it, is socialized medicine run by the government. So he came into the hospital, and due to his bad lung infection, he required intubation. His family wanted him to be intubated. There were three categories. It's like a Chinese menu in healthcare. You want basically nothing to be done for your relative. You want everything to be done in some kind of intermediate category. They checked off kind of everything to be done. So he was intubated. He was put on a ventilator, which is basically a tube that goes down your throat, helps you to breathe like a bellows, breathes in and out, helps your lungs. And he seemed to do okay. He wasn't fully conscious for a while. Then he seemed to make a recovery.
Did you say he had a tracheostomy?
In the past, he had a tracheostomy. Now he was on a ventilator. I'm sorry? They could put him back. I'm not sure at this point if they put him back on the trach. You'll see in a moment, however, that they weren't really concerned about that issue. As the end of the month was coming, it was getting close to the end of November, December 1st, one of the two doctors, the two foreign doctors, I think we're both foreign-born doctors in the ICU, you know, when I was training and you would leave an ICU or a unit, you'd want to kind of get rid of patients who were troublesome or, you know, stable, you move them to another ward. This doctor, however, might have had a different view of getting rid of a patient because he proposed to take off the ventilator, stop all feeding, and let Mr. Golubchik expire on December 1st. So this doctor came to the conclusion and convinced the head of the ICU that the way we should deal with this patient's inability to be taken off the ventilator was to basically take him off the ventilator, which would lead to his death in a matter of minutes, if not shorter than that, most likely. So the stage was set because, and just even more ironically, he was a very big Sabbath observer. As a matter of fact, the reason he moved to Winnipeg was because was it one of the only places he'd get a job where anyone could observe the Sabbath without violating his religion. So his children informed the hospital, among other things. The hospital realized that December 1st was a Saturday, right? Sabbath, Shabbat. So in their own sense of cultural competence, they said, you know, it won't be right to kind of kill him when his children won't be there or take him with the ventilator. We'll wait till Saturday night. You know, sundown will come, then the children can come, we can have a nice little performance, and then we'll take off the ventilator. His children were obviously not in agreement with this. The children, as any good Jewish family would do, went to a Jewish lawyer. They're here, the story kind of gets a little bit dicey because the family maintains that when the hospital doctors found out that they were going to a lawyer to get an injunction, they decided to extubate him Friday morning. So the lawyer for the family maintains that he was calling from the judge's chambers and they were actually pulling the plug, pulling him off the ventilator when he was screaming in the phone, don't do it, and apparently the judge may have had to get on the phone. In any event, this is what happened. The judge said, emergency injunction, do nothing until further notice. Ex parte, I think it's called injunction. It's like an emergency injunction, freeze everything, which kind of makes sense. At that point, so he got his first injunction. And then the next question, is there a doctor in the house? Well, there were two doctors who wanted to play the role here of ending his problem, as I said in my first version of the affidavit to the court, of coming up with a final solution to this man's problem. But there was no doctor that really seemed to be working on behalf of the family. So to make a long story short, a good Israel contacted me and another doctor and a couple of others, and two of us volunteered. The other doctor decided to drop out after a short period of time to try to re-look at the case and try to look into the case and see if there's anything that might argue in favor of continuing this man's life. One of the interesting things was that the doctors, who were represented by seven corporate lawyers, represented the doctors and the Canadian healthcare system and the hospital, as I said, it was undergoing transfer, described the patient as having minimal brain function. Any of you who've lectured on a Sunday morning know that could describe a whole varying, right? From the person who needs the coffee, I just saw Rav Meir Goldbach walk by, right? I sometimes sit on Monday nights when he goes, tries to give a lecture. But it's a term that's not used in neurology. I'm a neurologist. So I said, well, what does that mean? And then I insisted on getting a whole copy of the chart. They delayed getting us the chart. They didn't want to give us the chart, etc. In mid-December, the head of the ICU wrote an affidavit to the judge, did not inform him of the patient's true condition, in my opinion, continued to describe as having minimal brain function, and proposed a procedure to terminate his life, take him off the ventilator, stop his feeding, and if necessary, he said, give him a dose of narcotics. In my affidavit, I pointed out an inconvenient fact, and that is that that same morning, a few hours before he filed his affidavit, a doctor had written in the chart a big word in big letters. He wrote this word in the chart in very big letters. He wrote awake. And I wrote in my affidavit that it's inexplicable how, on the one hand, the hospital and their seven corporate lawyers are presenting this patient as having minimal brain function, which to those of us who are involved in end-of-life matters suggests, as I thought when I got the case, he's probably vegetative, he's probably close to brain dead. This is probably a matter the case will resolve itself within a matter of hours or days. They become brain dead, and that will speak for itself. He was, in fact, awake. Not only that, nurses were writing that he was following them visually from time to time. So he was not only awake, but he was tracking them, and his children were insisting that he was from time to time interactive. That, in my view, represented a major problem, even from the point of view of secular ethics. They were proposing, essentially, to kill, to actively euthanize a man who was awake, truly disabled, and difficulty in communicating. And I also pointed out to the judge that he had an aphasia. And I also pointed out, which had not been diagnosed by the family, by the doctors, and I also pointed out that they had never called for a neurologist to examine the patient. They hadn't had a neurologist examine him. They hadn't done an EEG. They hadn't done a full neurological evaluation, not even neurological testing, no CATs yet. They basically, in my view, had what we'd call a rush to judgment. I don't think the judge took very kindly to this kind of new information that had not been discussed or disclosed to him by the hospital itself, and he decided to grant a more permanent injunction, which was in February. Before that happened, however, and you'll see in your packet, kind of to make it interesting, now some disabled groups tried to rally to our support. Unfortunately, we tried to get some support in the organized Jewish community, and anybody knows the song "The Sound of Silence," you'll know that there was not a lot of support from the official Jewish community. There was a rabbi who wrote two or three times about it and was trying to work hard behind the scenes, but the support from the organized Jewish community was not very strong. And we can perhaps discuss that maybe off mic a little bit later. But the College of Physicians and Surgeons, which is basically a governmental body which licenses and registers and regulates doctors in Manitoba, which is the province where Winnipeg is, a city with tens of thousands of Jews and hundreds of thousands of residents, as I understand it, they jumped into the middle of this thing by issuing, with 48 hours notice, a new policy statement that basically mandated that patients in the condition of Mr. Golubchik be put to death. If you look at their policy, it says that if the family wants a patient to end their life, and the doctor feels there's room for hope and so on, the doctor must comply with the family. But if the family doesn't wants the fight to go on, and the doctor feels that the person's life is such that it will not be a meaningful life, not be interacting with, then the doctor must end his life. However, the doctor can have a colleague, another physician, sort of consult on the case. But it doesn't have to be a neurologist. You don't specify a neurologist, anybody qualified knowing that the man had an aphasia, which he obviously did not even seem to recognize. And that colleague did not have to be picked by the family or have an outside body. In other words, you could ask a dermatologist, or in your case, your mother's a pathologist, or your father ophthalmologist, hey, could you come and look at the patient? So, in the view of myself and many legal experts, including people at some major Jewish organizations who read this, this was a big threat, this policy, which remains in place today in Winnipeg, and is currently the policy. If you are a physician practicing in Winnipeg, you're expected to uphold this policy. Go to the website this afternoon if you don't believe me, and that's a mandatory policy for professional ethics of Winnipeg. You must, in Manitoba, you must carry out their guidelines. So Judge Percy Shulman ruled on the case that there had to be a permanent injunction, that there wasn't a due process, the family wasn't really given a fair chance here, and this case had to go to trial. The case then took two prongs to it. There was an internal battle in the Jewish community as to whether we should come out publicly. We were able to gather six or seven Jewish organizations together that were willing to come out with a statement publicly, but at the 11th hour, literally at the 10 minutes before the statement was about to be released to the media, it was quashed by somebody who felt that it would be the wrong thing to do. And so there was some disunity as to what tactics should be had. In the meantime, the media battle began in earnest. The Jewish Post started writing about the case. And other media, Haaretz, other media started, American media, Canada was all over the media. They were polling people, what do you think? They called it the Terry Schiavo case of Canada. Terry Schiavo's family wrote to the family in support. They started a website, Save Stephen Golubchik. In the website, you see a picture of Mr. Golubchik sitting up, awake and alert, looking at the camera. We suspect that the judge, who also was known to go on the internet, we also have seen some of the evidence that was put on the website. But the media, the Canadian media, started to shift. I guess, I don't know, the lobbying efforts and so on, but they started to portray the doctors as the victims, and in my view, started to vilify the family. The doctors, after all, felt they had this ethical dilemma. It was cruel for them to be asked to care for this patient. As a matter of fact, one doctor told publicly, he said it's torture to have to care for him. He developed bed sores. He apparently was neglected and developed bed sores. And they said it was torture for him to have to debride the bed sores. Debride is when if you let a patient lie for a long time, you don't care for them, they develop a breakdown of the skin. And then what you're asked to do is to cut away the areas of the skin where it's broken down or to turn them. That's just routine nursing care. But they felt that that was torture. Two of the doctors, the original two doctors, and then a third doctor said they would resign from his care. My understanding was, could you get it? You see, it's mom. It's urgent. I apologize. Two doctors, or maybe three doctors, resigned from his care, and apparently were allowed to care for other patients. Basically, they refused to carry out the judge's injunction. They didn't think they had to keep him alive. Instead of being vilified, they were applauded. They were acting professionally. That was a very scary turn of events to me, that the doctors were refusing to carry out the maintenance of his life until a trial could be held to see, if you will, who decides. So there was a media battle that was going on. It was being framed in a way that I thought took a negative turn. Finally, Mr. Golubchik, who the Globe and Mail, which is the premier sort of newspaper of Canada, they said he should not be allowed to reach his next birthday until he's brought to trial and this be disposed and so on. He did reach his 85th secular birthday, and he died 2 days later after his birthday party was held in his room. A few days before he died, Eric Struis, his family, said the Kriya Shema with him, and as they were saying, the tears came to his eyes. What prompted this case, and what is going on here? What is going on is that there is what Professor Avram S. Abraham, who's written this magnum opus, and this is an English whitewashed version of it. He doesn't include all the nitty-gritty in here, for those who are interested. He's a retired professor of medicine at Charlotte Tech. He calls this, he says in a recent conference with the American Orthodox Jewish scientists, he said that medicine has changed so much in the last few decades, it's hard to imagine how anybody can practice. What has happened is that, for various reasons, there's a theory called utilitarianism. And a bastard offspring of that theory is called feudal care theory. Feudal care theory, in my view, is an excuse. It's basically when doctors say, this patient is never going to be a world-class tennis athlete again, or his quality of life is never going to rise to the level that I, in my view, deem being a minimal quality of life. And therefore, it's wrong to keep him alive. As a matter of fact, it may be a waste of precious resources. I am not a halachic authority by any means. I've had the honor for the last 10 years to help run and participate in the Yachid Kala, where the doctors learn medical halacha with the chief rabbis of Israel and other leading halachic authorities. I'm kind of like boot camp for doctors. And we run many programs around the world as well. So I've learned many of these sugyas with some of the leading poskim. To my knowledge, there's no halachic authority in the world that would have countenanced removing care from a patient who was awake, as was not shown to be suffering, and did not express a wish to die. But on the contrary, all those who were his loved ones and how he was acting seemed to indicate that he wanted very much to live. So I ask you now the question, can you imagine such a scenario happening? If you can't, let me tell you that I spoke to colleagues, pulmonologists, someone who's in ICU and so on, and they tell me, Leon, they say this goes on almost every day in the hospital. If this guy's an Orthodox guy in the group, his non-Orthodox partners are pulling the plug almost every day. another guy's had him in ICU said, I came in one morning, and the nurses had withdrawn care from one of his cases without his directive. What is behind this again? Part of it is a philosophy, okay? This utilitarianism, John Stephen Billet said, which has become fuel care theory. Part of it is economics, in my opinion. 50%, if not more, of the healthcare dollar in most Western countries goes towards the last 6 months of life. If less people are using up that care, money would be saved, right? If let's say you're spending $10 billion, let's say for a random number, and half of those people are not being maintained, then you've saved, theoretically, some of that money. There is, however, in all honesty, people who have been trained, they've been indoctrinated in a secular philosophy or other philosophies, wherein they feel that this is the humane thing to do. You put that horse, was it Mr. Brown or whatever, that big Brown out of his misery after he broke his leg in the whatever race that was, right? They shoot horses, don't they? That's a phrase. And they feel that this is the humane thing to do. Again, I can't speak for halacha. I'm not a halachic authority. But I am troubled very much about a few factors in this case. One is that this is a case wherein the doctors move towards active euthanasia, right? There's inactive euthanasia, kind of a passive kind of a thing, right? And then there's active euthanasia, where you take steps to shorten somebody's life. And many of us felt this was active involuntary euthanasia. You were basically, if this was a mercy killing, you were doing it without the person's permission or consent. As a matter of fact, that was the legal basis for the argument. They said, but this is an assault on his body. He hasn't given consent to inject it with narcotics, etc. So, again, I think this is a problem, that this is the tip of the iceberg, the Golubchik case. We were hoping for a ruling from the judge. The family probably would have won in court, because for many procedural reasons. Let me just add a few other points. They decided to have a conference on this case. And they decided, let's have a conference. By coincidence, or maybe by design, they picked the day of the conference, the first day of Shavuot, when no Orthodox Jews, no conservative, no one would attend, no Jews in the community would attend. The first day of Pentecost, of Shavuot. And then they proceeded to have their conference to discuss what we should do with the case. Interestingly, in the Journal of Clinical Ethics, they had an end-of-life case at Harvard. And they didn't know what to do with the patient. And Professor Rosner, who was instrumental in my speaking here today, thank you, Dr. Rosner, he's one of my mentors. You don't always agree, but he is a titan. He was involved in this case and commenting on the Journal of Clinical Ethics. And they didn't know what to do with this clinical case, because this woman who was the guardian for her father wanted everything done. She was Orthodox. So here's how they decided the case. They decided, they got two non-Orthodox staff clergy to decide that it would be humane to withdraw care. And they said, it's Friday, we can't really bother her, she's getting ready for the Sabbath. And her rabbi's not going to be available. So they just stopped feeding the man and stopped his care on Friday. And then by the time she found out Saturday night, apparently his case had worsened. And they wrote this up in the Journal of Clinical Ethics without any embarrassment, that this was the way to do it. That's all. They had two clergy people. I think it was one reform rabbi and one reconstructionist rabbi who were paid by the hospital. And they didn't go to her rabbi or to her. She was the guardian. In this case, they didn't honor the guardian's wishes. They felt that it was futile. Moreover, they wanted to enforce this involuntary euthanasia. There was one woman who stood up against them. She's already had some backlash. There was a doctor who tried to support them, and his career was threatened. There was an ethicist who tried to support them, and I don't want to say what happened to her. But there was a third ethicist who has a national reputation. She's not Jewish. She was able to attend this conference, Professor Jocelyn Downey. And she got up and she basically said at this conference that you've gone too far, that there's no justification in Canadian law for this, and that this is dangerous. Okay, so there are two aspects, I think. There's the matter of the case itself. Perhaps this conference will also enable us to discuss what's the slippery slope, what are the implications? If we now say the doctors have the right, because in the United States, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, right, we have patient autonomy. This would have been a much harder case to achieve in the United States because you have the autonomy. You may have certain things withdrawn, certain things not. But here, who gets to decide? If the doctors can trump you by saying, well, it's futile, and if they say, you don't even have a doctor you can bring on your side because he's not licensed in our province, they wouldn't let me examine him because they said, you're not licensed in Canada. And their experts said that doctors in Paris are not qualified, and one of the reasons they said is because I haven't participated in these procedures in Canada, that these humane procedures of ending patients' lives. So it creates almost like a catch-22, where there's a small system of doctors who are going to be deciding, end of life matters, whether they're well-intentioned in their view, humane, helping the patient, or whether they have ulterior motives, maybe because they're employees of healthcare systems that want to cut costs, where people were threatened, who were trying to help the family, would threaten their jobs, I mean. Maybe there are other variables that are more sinister at play here. So I open it up to you, and I think you had a question for discussion.
I want to clarify 2 points.
You just want to identify yourself, or you don't have
to? Yeah. My name is Robbie Berman. I run the Halachic Organ Donor Society. I have 2 questions just to clarify the case, because it wasn't clear to me from what you had said. On the one hand, you had said that he had indicated that he wanted to live, but you also said he had aphasia and he could not communicate. So was he able to blink? Did he write? In what way did he indicate that he wanted to live? And number two, you had said that he wasn't suffering from anything, but I think you also said maybe wrong. I think you said he had bed sores, which is painful, which shows bone, which is bleeding, they have to cut away, which people suffer from as well. So was he not suffering? I don't understand.
Right. Well, first of all, his whole lifestyle had been one of wanting to keep the Jewish faith. There was a doctor in UCLA who was on a medical ethics committee at a hospital, and he got his hospital to put in their end-of-life protocol that one of the goals, you know, the goals that they seek in a hospital for a patient, right? Social workers, people talk about goals. And the goals of some patients are to keep their religion, right? Sarah Palin, whether we agree with her or not, to her keeping that baby when it was diagnosed as Down's, that was a goal that was more important to her at that moment than ending that baby's life. By the way, if you're interested, I left you a blurb for EFRAC, an organization I'm affiliated with. They're involved in parents who are struggling in Israel under financial strains, and it helps for those who choose to keep their babies, help provide them financial support. One way you can be an activist if you like. So first of all, his whole life spoke of a desire to live under such circumstances. He communicated his feelings to his children, okay, in conversations they had. Moreover, he never tried to take off the tracheostomy. He wasn't uncomfortable drinking. He was sitting up, and he never showed any signs of pain. However, because of the issue of the bed sores and other issues with this patient, I discussed this case with several postgame a few weeks ago in Exosfell. I discussed with Moshe Sternbach, some other major postgame. And the outcome of Dori Ayachet Kala, and the basic, my understanding of the basic halakhic point of view of the major postgame I discussed with, if you have a patient where they're claiming that he has minimal brain, they say a minimal conscious state. They said that was their neurologist who finally flew in at great expense to examine him. They say he had a minimally conscious state. But he did not describe any type of pain. So they kind of wanted to have it both ways. He wasn't conscious enough to interact, enough to feel perception, apparently, but on the other hand, to keep him alive would be painful. So I asked Rav Moshe Sternbach this question. I said, you know, a patient like this, that let's say he was comatose, and you couldn't really be sure. Is he in pain? Is he not in pain? And he opted, as did other postgame I spoke to, I have not found one who said otherwise, that in the app, you cannot assume that the patient is in pain and should not be treated. As a matter of fact, if the person in a coma or just it's unclear, you have to assume, and moreover, he was not given pain medication. They weren't giving oral opiates, morphine, or narcotics. So if he was in pain, why weren't they treating the pain? Okay, so from my point of view as an expert for the family, I did not find evidence in the chart, nor in the people, and I had a colleague of mine actually went and examined him. Tape running start to describe more. Let's just say somebody I know went and actually saw him, and also did not describe him as evidence of any pain. They refused to let the family be present when they were supposedly treating the bed sores. And also, when the Chevra Kedisha was preparing for burial, they could not find the bed sores. All right? So the Chevra Kedisha has the ability to put in writing if it ever comes to it. They could not find the bed sores that they were supposedly there. So either they miraculously went away during the death process, which would have been an open miracle, right? If he was Catholic, he'd now be being put up the sainthood, or something was not kosher
In Denmark. Yes, question? Or another, you had another question? The second part of it was? Yes.
So I'm just, I'm not clear. Did the hospital claim that they have a standing code which allows them to define him? Was there some objective criterion that he met, or was it his attending physician? Because it seems like just, I mean, incomprehensible. How did they justify their position?
To my knowledge, there was no written protocol or anything that could justify what they did, nor in Canadian law, according to Professor Jocelyn Downey, who's apparently some healthcare professor at Dalhousie, one of the major universities, and she's like, there's like several national, they paid like these people to be like national scholars for healthcare and ethics, and she's one of them. It's like seven of them in the United States. And she said there's no precedent in Canadian law.
The hospital said bioethics committees?
I don't know if that hospital had a functioning bioethics committee. They had an ethicist come. He did not address some of the issues that they made a decision. He addressed some side issues. It seems like they made a decision. It seems like this was their standard of care. And they witnessed several times the family patients who were there for a couple of days and they'd just be extubated very promptly. Part of the problem was like this, in all fairness to the doctors, they did not have a long-term care facility for ventilated patients. Apparently in this province and apparently throughout Canada, there's a tremendous scarcity of those kinds of facilities. So since they couldn't extubate him, they were kind of stuck, if you get what I'm saying.
Did they have a palliative care department?
I'm not aware that they had a palliative care department.
So I'm just trying to understand the analogy. And obviously,
the charts like this, I don't remember every single page.
I'm just trying to understand, what type of defense they have if there isn't some type of a protocol that they can follow. Was it an individual physician that made the decision? Was this done by a department? Because many hospitals, even big ones, if they have an ethics committee, they don't always present a case. If they're going to present cases, and that this committee sometimes if they fit is going to be a rival suit. So I'm just trying to understand. I saw this in the media, I read some of it, I found it incomprehensible. Right. So how do they, what is their defense here? Was there one individual physician that was granted this approval? Was there a department? How did they justify that?
It never made it to trial because after he expired, the family which had acquired tens of thousands of dollars of legal bills decided to end the case. And they're still paying off their attorney. The hospital, of course, because their seven corporate attorneys are being paid by the government, didn't have those kind of legal battles. There was a case where Mr. Jin, in another part of Canada, he came from China, and was visiting family, relocated, and he became comatose 7 months before this happened. And the hospital doctors decided that his care was futile, and they were going to extubate him and let him die as well. The Asian family ran and got an injunction similar to the Golubchik family, and they wrote in their affidavits apparently that he would never wake up, he was going to be a PDS, this was a futile case. Within 24 hours, Mr. Jin was awake, communicating. A few days later, he walked out of the hospital. The hospital continued the case. The family dropped the case. Mr. Jin went back to China, I guess he wanted to. I guess, you respect your elders in the old Asian society. I'm getting out of here. But Mr. Jin wanted out of Canada, but the hospital continued the case on the appellate division and so on. They want a ruling. They said, no, we were right all along. There is a tremendous schism in amongst, if you read this College of Statement from the College of Physicians and Surgeons, which they came out with, knowing that the judge was about to rule in the Golubchik case, they came out with a statement. I forget he might have moved in mid-January instead of mid-February, I might have misspoke. But they came out to insert themselves into the case and to say, oh, in a case like this, and as a matter of fact, now, if any of you are traveling out through Manitoba, if you're traveling on behalf of Holmes and you get a chest cold, be careful to get out of Manitoba, because according to the College of Physicians and Surgeons, if they determine that your life is not worth living, and they don't have any objective criteria, they're not the neurologist, they're not the EEG, an EKG, they're not there anything. A doctor and his buddy, his physician colleague, to make the determination, and they must, according to that protocol, end your life. I hope I'm wrong. I've gone over this with several lawyers, not only with Israel, but other major organizations were involved. And this stays on the books. That's their professional policy right now. There are people who are trying to convince them to rewrite it. I don't want to go into too much because it takes this long. Yes.
Lawrence from Neurosurgery in New Jersey. I wonder if you can comment. As a board member of the Lucky Organ, I wonder if you could comment on legalize medicine, because this would never happen. I mean, basically because the hospital itself and the doctors themselves would not risk that kind of legal liability in going against the family's wish of terminating the life and playing something the hospital wouldn't want that publicity. So I'm wondering if it's now they're acting on behalf of the entire Canadian health system, they feel protected. This is, to the public, this is all our health system. This is all our patients.
You know, it's very hard to speak. When this came up, we contacted several people in Canada. First of all, we tried to get doctors in Canada to agree to testify and get involved. There was a tremendous reluctance. Apparently, if a doctor in Canada would do this, this would be the a big mark on him, and there might be ways that he, as I told you, there were professionals who were literally called into the office. One person got involved in the case and was called to the office that afternoon by her CEO. I don't want to go into more details, but there are many factors in play here. I can't speak for the Canadian medical system, but I can tell you that in their journal, they basically lambasted the family in April. You can read the journal, the article, I did not include it in the packet. And they basically want legislation. The Canadian physicians apparently, well, again, most of them are employed apparently at the government, so you wonder who's pulling the blue strings. But apparently they want legislation to remove the ability of families like the Golubchiks and the Jims to even argue against it. What concerns me, if you have any relatives in Canada, is that my concern about this case is twofold. One is the heart of the case itself, okay? But also the implications for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people as they become elderly. In this country, my father now is fighting for his life on a ventilator in South Florida. South Florida, I believe, has a futile care rule, okay, as does Texas, the two Bush states, right? In South Florida, there was an Orthodox Jewish girl who, Rob, you may know more about this than I do, but what I remember was she fell into a backyard pool, and she was either brain dead or very close to it, and the Children's Hospital in South Florida wanted to disconnect her from the ventilator under the futile care law, which I believe is currently on the books in Florida. The family was the hospital was threatened, as you predicted, with publicity. A good few Israel, others threatened with adverse publicity, and they kind of made this situation. Now she's being cared for at home in North Miami Beach by the Orthodox family, whose rabbi and their beliefs were that she should be continued to be treated. Let me just say, this family went to their rabbi, and then they went to double. So there was more than one rabbi involved in this family, so they didn't act arbitrarily. A misunderstanding, I hope, is not going to be spread. They did what they felt was halakhically obligated to do. They were told that by more than one rabbi, so they did their halakhic homework. It's not like they were deciding, on the spur of the moment. They were asking shaylos, and I know some of the people who were involved in answering the shaylos. Some of the shaylos ended up being discussed amongst Gedolei Poskim and Eretz Yisrael because they were in a tough dilemma, and they still are. But from a halakhic point of view, I'm not aware of any post-sec who could say that in this case, a man who's awake, who hasn't said he wants to die, whose family says, do everything, who they're hypothesizing might be having pain, but is not showing signs of it. Visually, he's not grimacing. He's not showing any signs of pain. And they're not treating him with painkillers. I don't understand how, even ethically, it's very troublesome to me. There's a precedent for this in the 1930s in Germany. Doctors, if you read the book The Nazi Doctors, Robert Lifton, he wrote a book where he talks about German medicine. They used to have bioethics committees, and they would discuss disabled patients they started with those who were imminently dying, then they worked on those who were severely brain damaged and dying, then they worked on those severely brain damaged, then minimally brain damaged, and they worked their way up. So there was a slippery slope issue. And I think in Sparta also, right, ancient Sparta, they put people on icebergs the Vikings. So it's not without precedent in medicine, but to me it's kind of a scary precedent. Yes?
I think this is a very serious case. I agree that I don't think this could happen in the United States at this point for multiple reasons. But there were several other side issues that you mentioned that I would like to touch on. There was one, when you mentioned that the doctors were allowed to withdraw themselves from the case. That happens all the time in the United States. It happens every time, often. And that is not necessarily a bad thing, because there are times when a family, non-Jewish family, says, I want to take the patient off the ventilator, and if I or any person feels that I can't do that, they should be allowed to withdraw themselves from that situation, not abandon the patient. You're not allowed to abandon the patient. You have to find someone else to care for that patient. But as far as a matter of allowing yourself, because of my principles, I don't agree with that, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And often that becomes a protective mechanism for many of us who practice medicine.
I think the hospital had certain obligations, however, to obey a court order. When a judge says, keep him alive and do all these procedures, and gave instructions to them and to these doctors, I think for the doctors to say, well, we're designing care from this one patient, but we're going to care for other patients in the unit, in effect, in this small ICU where there were only a few people who were qualified, in effect, what they were doing was, one could argue that they were essentially refusing to carry out the judge's orders. Now, there are ethicists in Canada with whom I've interacted who have framed it exactly what you did, saying this is a matter of professional ethics. If they really view this as futile, well, they couldn't continue. I can understand the individual, but one has to wonder about a healthcare system wherein that would be the solution that they would come up with.
I mean, you can only argue that if there's some type of a protocol which defines when a doctor is allowed to withdraw from a case, if the general consensus in the medical field is his medical condition, as you presented it, warranted intervention, I mean, any hospital or physician would be very, very hard-pressed to withdraw themselves.
Why? As long as you find someone else to take care of the patient.
Well, that would be acceptable, but I'm saying withdraw care and allowing the person just to expire.
No, that's something a little different.
Yeah,
that's perhaps
in the beginning, they wanted to actively take off his ventilator, stop his feeding, and give him a dose of morphine. That's what they wrote in their protocol. A dose of narcotics. If the first two steps did not achieve their goal, they were going to give him a dose of narcotics. That, to me, sounds like a protocol to kill somebody. And that's what I objected to my affidavit. And also, they had no standardization for anything they wanted to do. It was all kind of like, let's just do it, you know, and then the argument that they're a neurology expert was, well, Dr. Zakharis is not qualified. Part of the reason is because I'm not licensed in Canada, and I haven't participated in these procedures. To me, that's very troublesome, okay? Part of my original affidavit, and it was revised, was that this is like a protocol, you know, like if you ask the doctor to participate in the, I objected first on moral grounds. You're asking me to comment on a protocol to end somebody's life. You know, that's a moral, very, you know, the doctor's, you know, Texas execution, you have to give the injection. There are many states that say that you can't participate in that. But moreover, I think the problem here was when the media and the doctors started running with this and reframing it as kind of a professional ethics, I think it's a big dilemma. Do I think, yeah, there is a dilemma. If you feel that care you're giving is completely futile, yeah, there is a dilemma. But, you know, how do you solve that dilemma in a greater sense? You are sometimes withdrawn from the case when you're the only one providing for the patient, I think is an ethically problematic thing. Anyway, we could agree to disagree, yes.
I'm surprised that there haven't been any other cases before this, given the fact that the system allows this. I mean, why did it suddenly happen now, and for years and years, there's never been a case like this?
Well, there was the gin case. There's now a case in Italy, I think it's in Italy, wherein the family wants the person taken off. Apparently she's in a PBS-like state. They want the person taken off all care, and the doctors are doing the opposite. They're saying, apparently they're Catholics or something, that they won't stop care. So it's almost a reverse case of this. But there always are cases, but not everyone ends up in court. Sometimes the doctors persuade the family. For example, I've had a relative who was in critical. The doctors and neurologists persuade the family or somebody, you know, it's not worth it, you should have suffered. Why feed him? Anyone who attended the Winter ALJS conference will learn about that nutrition and end-of-life care is another issue. I did want to mention a timer ventilator. It's the last page of the handout. This is a new argument. Now, why is this tied to the case? The case, actually, people in the media in Canada said, oh, Israel has an end-of-life protocol, and they actually have a timer ventilator. I remember seeing something like that in Canadian media. So if it's good enough to Jerusalem, why don't we get some kind of protocol here? Here is the Steinberg Committee in Israel, and I studied many years with Professor Steinberg, I respect him very highly, was a committee that was set up and came up with legislation that has been passed to try to solve end-of-life cases in Israel. I don't know if it's been addressed in this conference, but if any of you are serious about medical ethics, secular medical ethics at least, should look at the Steinberg committee's end-of-life protocols. However, some people felt that in halacha, and again, I cannot speak about halacha, I'm not qualified. There are some svarim people who do write svarim in this. But some people feel that if care is discontinuous, that you may have more halachic leeway. You cannot withdraw care, but maybe you can withhold care. So if you're going to give a certain treatment every Monday morning at 10, you know, dialysis, like this patient needed dialysis at some point. That was a halachic issue. This patient actually, in symptomatic, actually had dialysis at one point. That was a halachic issue. We had some post-team discussing that. It was decided that he should get dialysis. Part of the reason was because we could not establish he was in any pain, or that he wanted his life to be shortened. And the way to present dialysis, it was a hassle for them to bring the machine and so on, but for him it was simply a matter, it wasn't a major invasion. But in any event, this time of ventilator is a notion that sounds interesting. It's based on the notion that if you have a ventilator that kind of is like a Shabbos type, it goes off every 30 minutes or 30 days or something, then maybe you could, when it's about to go off, you know, tick, 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 maybe you could decide just to go and restart if this patient is not worth continuing. I have not met, I spoke to four post-team, several participated in Ayat Ekala. I personally went to the hospital of Neuwirth. He was quoted by someone as saying that he's in favor of this. He said, and in front of four of us, he said, this is murder to use this machine from the point of view of Jewish law. This relates to whether you can kill somebody indirectly and so on and so forth. It is way beyond I couldn't even begin to understand the halachic issues. All I can say is that this is of interest that an Eretz Yisrael and Esau, people are grappling with end-of-life cases and how do you solve them, right? One solution that has been recommended is this time of ventilator. I am not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that at least four major post-schemes, Rav Sternbach, Rav Neuwirth, Rav Zalman and Goldberg, these represent different camps, and Rav Morgenstern, who represents Rav Yashin, excuse me, and Rav Morgenstern's five post-schemes, have said that it would be considered murder to use this under Jewish law. I mean, emotionally, if you ask me, that sounds like a pretty strong kind of faith. But are people grappling with these things? Yes. Are there simple solutions? No.
We have gone over it. I might be killed if you guys miss lunch.
Two more questions.
Right?
Yeah. Charity has been using this for a long time to deal with the situation of if you have a trauma patient who comes in with severe head injury and you don't know the extent of that head injury, okay? Commonly what we're grappling with was you intubate them, put them on a ventilator, and now you're stuck because everybody agrees you can't take them off. But if I knew how severe it was, there's plenty of any halachically I could say, I can't do anything, it's okay not to do anything at that point. So that was a problem they dealt with. So they dealt with that by saying they could have put the patient on a timed ventilator and then reassess that patient after he had his CAT scan, after he had his evaluations, and then say, and then when the timer goes off, the patient's like off the ventilator, you're starting from scratch again. It's as if you came in, not taking it off the ventilator, but your ventilator is off. And now you're dealing with the situation from scratch again, saying, should we intubate, should we continue to ventilate this patient or not, depending on what the condition is. They've been using this for a long, long time, okay? Now it came up as part of the registered protocol, so the commission. But this is not a means of saying, I'm going to put him on a timer, and then when it goes off, nobody do anything about it. That's not what they're talking about.
I've spoken to several of the major people out at the AMJS conference. When it was discussed most recently, it was discussed to use for the live, let me finish, for live awake patients who are alert, such as Lou Gehrig's ALS patient says, I don't want to go on a machine, I'm afraid of this, but I'll go on it as long as it's time to ventilate, okay? That's how it's being envisioned.
The same thing as far as changing to be.
I'll make you a deal. I'll finish my sentence, then we'll finish yours. Okay. But the original tshuva of the Sitz Eliezer related to a case there were no, as I recall, there were no signs of life, and the Sitz Eliezer's tshuva has been used to now be applied. Well, let's try this to a patient who's awake and doesn't want to be on a ventilator, and therefore we would extend his life. He's going to either die, or at least offer him this, and maybe he'll get used to it. I am not discussing ethics or the halacha of it. I'm not qualified. All I'm just saying is presenting to you that this is kind of a... The issue that I do want to, however, say is, I continue my run-on sentence and I'll get back to you, is that what concerned me, the Golubchik case,
is that they were citing the Steinberg Law Committee and the time of ventilator, and I guess what we have to be aware of, all of us, is that there's a small world out of there. What we say in this room or anywhere sometimes has a long reach of major ramifications. My plea to anybody who's involved in medical halacha is I myself have raised my voice at Polsky. Even recently, I haven't yet been beaten up. In one case, I was involved to join, I invited to join the prison's co-op, because you argue very well. But the place to argue these things is not in the public domain, because what happens in the media is that it is misunderstood, and what Professor Steinberg originally intended might be misused. Period. Back to Dr.
So basically, use this same kind of mechanism addressing when you change your tubing, every hospital has a different protocol, whatever it is, using the same principle that when you change the tubing, basically you take the patient off the ventilator at that point, and then you reassess the patient. So that was the same principle that was applied here, and it was never meant actually a way to just terminate patients and say, okay, the clock ran out, you got, that's it, I don't want to do anything.
I think we've done one more.
One of the things that fears me and possibly others here with the Golubchik decision is that it feeds into the fears that the public have. The public has not only those people in Canada, but even, let's say, in America, but the impact of poor hospital policy or medical policy with dying patients on the whole transplantation issue. There's one implication, obviously, about the survival of people who are ill, and that clearly is the primary issue, which is the tragedy here. The other flip side is to what extent they'll be confident that prior to transplant, and I'm someone who was very encouraging of it, a party will need to indeed expire. And do you have an idea what the Canadian policy is? On what grounds will they allow transplantation? I'm just wondering if this.
You would probably best to talk to Dr. Ruben Volker on the transplant issue. I mean, so he's very involved in many aspects. Well, I didn't want to read one thing, but one question.
Just because you put the website up there and you mentioned Yahweh Kalah, all the rabbis that you mentioned, most of them in the books that you have up there, have very one Weltanschauung, if you will. I'm curious, for the 10 years that you've been involved with Yahweh Kalah, concerning the issue of brain death, which those folks all reject brain death. And you mentioned Fred Rosner as being a titan. Has Yahweh Kalah ever had one of those titans, such as Albert Steinberg or Fred Rosner, you said you learned that in respect? Have they ever presented a pro-brain death position at your Yahweh Kalah?
Yes. Professor Alan Steinberg presented this year as a Mordechai Eliyahu more than 1 year I was a translator for him. There have been other folks here. Rav Zalman Goldberg recently presented his view on brain death. I view it a little differently. I wouldn't use the word Weltanschauung. To me, it's a habit like mathematics. First of all, I don't understand, when they did quantum mechanics with Einstein and Bohr. I still don't understand why they couldn't get along in Copenhagen way back when they had their pivotal meeting. I think for those of us who are, seeing from the, watching the Gedolim or the Kosky, or if you want to see those who say Weltanschauung, I call it Torah Hashkafa, we might tend to lend our own kind of bias. So this one is right wing, or that one's left wing, but he hasn't considered this or that. But I have sat with post team. I have seen them tear up. I have seen them deal with difficult dilemmas. And I do think that this is a field like a high level mathematics, a high level physics. It's the most complicated field. Here we use a neurosurgeon. Okay, I am sure I'm a neurologist, I know a little bit about nurses, I participated, but it would be chutzpah for me. It would be chutzpah for me to second guess what a qualified neurosurgeon was debating with his colleague in the middle of an operation. And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the most complicated subject, most complicated aspect of life. And let's be honest, the ethicists themselves are grappling with this. I didn't want to finish with one thing. I'm reading from the Mishnah of Abraham, who quotes every single halakhic authority that I know of, even quotes Emmanuel Jacobowitz and others. He says, in conclusion, I cannot emphasize strongly enough that these are life and death decisions. He's talking about
laws concerning end of life. These are life and death decisions that can be made only by a POSEC who must be made fully aware of the medical facts as decided by a full team of medical experts. Although allowing a patient to die is not the same as actively killing him, it is nevertheless a very serious sin. Unlike the world at large, that is more and more coming to believe that there is no difference between withholding and stopping nourishment, oxygen, and treatment in a terminal and even not-so-terminal patient, and that both are permissible, halakha clearly differentiates between the two. Stopping is never permissible, and withholding may be, but only in very particular circumstances, and then only with the express ruling or recognized and medically informed POSEC. No two patients and no two circumstances are exactly alike, and only a POSEC can decide when one may allow a patient to die, and one must continue to fight, even for a few more moments of life, even if only artificially maintained. As physicians, we should approach these very difficult problems of life and death with humility and realize our fallibility and lack of absolute knowledge. We must accept completely the tenets of our Torah as expounded by our sages with the readiness to listen to and put into practice what they tell us. We must be willing to control our emotions, including those of pity and compassion, within the boundaries set by the Torah. We who hold life and death in our hands must therefore continually remind ourselves that the Almighty only gave us permission to treat. When I wrote to the Canadian Jewish News on this case, I wrote a eulogy for the patient that was read at his funeral, but I said something that I believe is a true statement. Physicians should always try to cure, should always care, but should never kill. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.